This audio file comes from the Libri Ideas Library at www.libri-ideas-library.org. The library contains over 1,000 lectures and discussions which explore questions about the reality and relevance of Christianity. We ask you to respect the copyright for this audio file, which belongs to Libri Fellowship. The file is for personal use to share with friends, family and colleagues, but please do not publish the material in any format or post it on a website without seeking permission from Libri Fellowship. Please note that views expressed in the lecture and discussion time do not necessarily represent the views of Libri Fellowship.
Tonight I'm going to be lecturing, it's the first part of a three-part series, and it's a topic that I've done a lot of speaking on before. And so for those of you who have been coming to Libri Lectures for a long time, or those of you who listen to the podcast, this may be some familiar material. But I'm speaking about gratitude and thankfulness, and the series is starting out tonight with a very sort of basic kind of biblical teaching on what thankfulness is. And then the last lecture of this term, I'm kind of bookending the term, so tonight and then the last lecture of term, I'm going to be talking about one of the main enemies of gratitude in our culture, which is entitlement. So that's the sort of the tug of war between gratitude and entitlement. And then at some point in the future, probably next term, I'm going to lecture on towards an apologetic of gratitude, because gratitude is a fascinating thing to many people today who don't share our faith at all. It's a very interesting conversation to be had there. What's the difference between secular contemporary views of gratitude and a biblical view of gratitude? Anyway, so stay tuned for those. But tonight we're starting off with just what is thankfulness for the Christian. So this is gratitude part one. What is thankfulness for the Christian? And how many of you, and certainly this has been my experience a little bit, but how many of you, when you were children, were reminded to say thank you? Is this, okay, see, it's the hand up in the back. All right, Elsie, all right, good. What do you say? You know, this is something that most of us have probably heard at some point or other. What do you say if you were given a gift and you immediately asked for something else? Usually, the adults in our life would have taken a dim view of that, right? If you were given something and you immediately asked for something more. Why is that? Why did the grown-ups in our life get on our case about that? Were they just being uptight? Was it a matter of etiquette or just social convention that this is what polite children do, and what would your aunt and uncle think if you didn't say thank you? Or was it something intrinsically right that you were being told to do? To say thanks. Could we use the word ought in a deeper sense than just being polite? You really ought to say thank you. Not just you ought to, as in polite children say thank you, but you really ought to. That's one of my questions tonight to throw out there. And then what about when we pray? What if every time we prayed, the first thing out of our mouth was telling God what he needed to do for us? Sometimes we're in positions where we have to just do that because that's the most pressing thing in our minds. And that's what comes out, and I think that's fine. But what if that was the way we prayed all the time? If that was the norm? And so many of us have probably been told to pray using the acronym ACTS, ACT. You know, you start with adoration, then you move on to confession, then you move on to thanks, and then you finally, at the very end, supplication. So, saying thank you before you make a request is somehow significant. But why? Surely it's more than good etiquette, again, and social convention. These things don't quite apply to our relationship to God. It's also more than good tactics. Sometimes it's good strategically to start with something positive before we ask something, you know. It's more than that, right? That's not really how we relate to God. But I want to take it seriously, but without making a legalistic rule out of that. There is something actually that's fairly wise about this, about saying thank you before we say other things to God or ask for things. without making a point to start with Thanksgiving, I think we lose track of who God is. We lose track of who we're talking to if we make a consistent habit of that. Who are we talking to? We're talking to the one who is first and foremost, and above all things, the giver of gifts, the one who's given us everything we have. We also fundamentally lose track of who we are as the receiver of gifts. Each and every one of us is a receiver of things that we haven't earned or that we don't deserve. So I think for Thanksgiving to be prominent in our prayers is actually just good theology. It helps us to keep good theology, helps us to remember who God is. And it's also, if you want to use these terms, it's also good anthropology. It helps us remind us who we are. Self-knowledge is important when we're speaking to God. So, being thankful, it sounds simple enough. How is it that I'm going to belabor this for three whole lectures, you may be asking? Giving thanks actually is not complicated, but it's difficult. And there's obviously a big difference between that. It's not complicated. I mean, our small children basically get the idea, even if they don't want to say thank you. They understand the concept, right? But it's difficult. It's about knowing the truth, and it's about responding to the truth, but it's also about being inwardly transformed by it so that we grow to love the truth. And that's the part that's hard. So we want to be people, I think most of us, particularly those of us who are Christians, we want to be people who can move from simply saying thank you to being thankful people. People who don't need to be prodded anymore like we were when we were a kid, or reminded that it would be it's a good time to say thank you. So that's just by way of introduction, and I'm just going to launch into just talking a little bit about what gratitude is. This is my outline. Well, no, it's not my outline. It's just my first section. I'm not going to give you my outline. Sorry. What is it that we're talking about? Eventually, I'll launch into more of a just kind of a very quick overview of the biblical story and viewing it in terms of gratitude, and then we'll move on from there. But in any case, there's a lot of definitions for gratitude today, depending on where you look. The way I'm using the word, it involves two things, basically. First, gratitude is an inner awareness that you've received goodness from outside yourself. It's a recognition that you've been given something. And one way of describing it, I think, is that you could say it's a way of interpreting your story such that good things are recognized as gifts. A way of interpreting your story such that good things are recognized as gifts. It's actually quite easy not to recognize good things as gifts. And that's what I'll be talking about when we come to entitlement. Entitlement is all about not recognizing gifts as gifts. But gratitude is about having the awareness to recognize good things as gifts. And again, this sounds simple, but it's often not. So that's the first aspect of it, this inner awareness that we've received goodness from outside ourselves. Secondly, the second sort of aspect of gratitude is that it's an experience of positive benevolence towards the giver of the gift. So we experience something good and our hearts turn to the source of that goodness, whoever it might be. And so this is a recognition that there was actually intention behind the gift. It was given with intent. It was on purpose. And at the heart of gratitude, there is this sense that the giver of the gift deserves praise. So in a sense, gratitude is an impulse to praise. And I'm not just talking about praise of God, an impulse to praise someone who has given you something good. So those are the two aspects of gratitude. I'm going to offer you a couple of observations now about what I've just said. There's lots of definitions and people will quibble over what exactly it is and isn't, but this is how I'm using the word tonight, just so you know. But it's a couple observations. Four, actually. Whatever the gift is, whatever it is, it has to be freely given to you. So it's not owed to you, and it's not earned by you, and the giver is not compelled to give it to you in any way at all. So the word gratuitous is often used of gifts. Gratuitous didn't have to be, it just was given anyway. Unnecessary, and yet given. And so it's a mistake to think of the gift as inevitable or automatic. No true gift is inevitable or automatic. It has to be given freely. Again, we come back to intent, a choice of the giver. Second observation, gratitude is an emotion. We sometimes forget that's actually an emotional state we're in. But it's a unique emotion. First of all, it's the only emotion we experience that is intrinsically other-directed. It necessarily involves another person. So you can be angry at yourself. You can be happy about yourself. You can be proud or ashamed of yourself. You could even be afraid of yourself sometimes. But you can't be grateful to yourself. To say I'm grateful to myself is nonsensical. So it's an emotion that by definition looks outward towards another. We can only be grateful to parents, siblings, children, teachers, friends, helpful strangers, doctors, whoever, God himself. But it's always directed outward. And in that sense, it's fairly unique among emotions. Third observation, so far, my definition of gratitude that I've given you is internal only. It's an internal experience. It's an inner feeling. And this is where gratitude differs from thanksgiving. And this is a very, very important distinction I'll be making tonight, and so just keep it in mind. So gratitude is different from thanksgiving. Thanksgiving, as the word implies, is to give thanks. It's an outward expression of thanks. If I give thanks to God, I am saying thank you. Even if I'm giving thanks to God silently in prayer, I am still saying thank you because it implies communication with the giver, actual communication, in a way that gratitude does not necessarily. So thanksgiving is gratitude expressed, you could say. We have an internal emotion and an external expression of that emotion. And the last observation I'll make before moving on, gratitude and thanksgiving, this internal experience and this external expression, they obviously belong together, right? They should be together. Gratitude is meant to be expressed as thanksgiving. If gratitude remains an internal experience only, something is wrong, right? I call this thanksgiving rather than thanksgiving. So this idea, I thought I made that up, and then I Googled it, and someone else had thought of that a long time ago, so I was disappointed. Anyway, thanksgiving is feeling really grateful but saying nothing, right? And in a sense, at Labrie, we talk about sentimentality a lot as a great enemy of the truth, and certainly something that's been very damaging, I think, to the Christian faith for a long time. But thanksgiving is a sort of sentimentality, actually, because it's a preoccupation with an emotional experience that leads to no outward action at all. So I can stay at home all day feeling good about myself for feeling grateful, right? And never once say thank you to anyone. That's thanksgiving. I can feel good about the fact that I feel grateful, and it never goes any further than that. And I talked about gratitude being an impulse to praise. Well, in the case of thanksgiving, it stays an impulse. It doesn't get past the impulse phase. So, still talking about the fact that thanksgiving and gratitude belong together. Gratitude is meant to be expressed as thanksgiving. But equally important, thanksgiving is meant to be an indication of a genuine inner gratitude. That's the other half of the equation there. If all we do is say thank you without ever being grateful in our hearts, then something else is wrong. This is thanks speaking. Both in contrast to thanksgiving, right? Whereas thanksgiving is akin to sentimentality, thanks speaking at its worst can really just be hypocrisy. Representing ourselves falsely, giving an impression that we're much more grateful than we really are. In the prophets, you often hear things like, "You praise me with your lips, but your hearts are far from me." Right? God sees these things, and he's impossible to fool. And so, outward, just expressions of praise and loyalty, if the inner person is worshiping someone else or is really not that interested in pleasing God at all, it doesn't fly with God. And so, some of Jesus' most critical words are about this very thing. Saying one thing and really believing and caring about another thing. Thanks speaking. So, I'm stating the thanksgiving and thanks speaking in very extreme terms. Most of us are, you know, guilty of various versions of this all day long. So, this is not a big condemnation here of any of us, although this is just something to be aware of. I think part of being spiritually healthy and part of being an integrated person is having our internal and our external lives actually match up. That's what it means to be a coherent person. What I think and believe in my heart is what I say and what I express outwardly. And of course, very few of us do that perfectly or consistently. So, thanksgiving and gratitude belong together, and I think part of growing in the Christian faith is learning how to have those two things be together in our lives. So moving along, what does the Bible have to say about all this? And this is obviously a very inadequate treatment of all of Scripture. But very often it's helpful to sort of break the grand biblical narrative into these four acts, as if it's a play, and talk about creation as the first act, the fall as the second act, redemption in Christ, act three, and then act four is the final fulfillment or restoration. And I think it's actually quite fruitful to kind of view the story from this. This is the sort of the 30,000 foot view of the Bible, but through the lenses of thankfulness, just sort of cast our eyes over the broad story with thankfulness in mind and see what we come up with. So, Act 1 is creation. One of my favorite verses in the whole Bible is Psalm 24, the very first verse, and it's affirming the first chapters of Genesis, and it says, "The earth is the Lord's and everything in it." This is a wonderful, unambiguous statement. The earth is the Lord's and everything in it. There's a lot in that small statement. It says a lot about the value of the world that God has made and the value of creation. But we can go into that later. Genesis is unambiguous on this point. The Lord is the sole source of everything. He's unrivaled in the beginning of Genesis. He's not one God among many, sort of battling for control. And he creates the whole universe, and his creation is made both intentionally — it's not some byproduct of some primordial war between the gods. It's made intentionally with no rival, and it's made gratuitously, in a sense. That word again. In other words, he did not have to make anything. He's under no obligation. Another way of saying this is that God's creation of the world is contingent, and that word is used in many different ways. When I use the word contingent, it means something that in fact happened, but not by logical necessity. Didn't have to happen in this particular way, but it happened because God wanted it to. So that's what I mean by God isn't compelled creation is gratuitous and contingent. Creation does not meet a need of gods either. We had a conversation the other day at our lunch table with some students, and the whole question of, was God lonely or something? Is that part of why he made the world and made people, to satisfy some need he had? And the Bible doesn't really give us that impression at all. It's not a solution to some problem he has. Rather, it's out of the profound and overflowing love that is there within the Trinity that creation is made. God makes the world. God makes human beings because he feels like it. And he wants to love more things. there's a wonderful, I'm not sure where this came from, maybe Nikayla could, an African Christian saying that said, God made you because he thought you would enjoy it. It was just a beautiful, it just cuts through a lot of stuff. And he made you because he'd enjoyed it. Didn't have to. So, one insight about Genesis 1 is that creation is God's extravagant hospitality to people. And this is, I think, that when you read the very first chapter of Genesis and you take seriously the sort of order of events as the writer of Genesis lays them out, it's pretty striking. In the first 5 days of creation, leading up to the creation of humans, which most Genesis scholars will say is kind of the pinnacle of the thing, sort of building up to that point where human beings are made. Those first 5 days leading up to the creation of Adam and Eve, God is making habitable space for living creatures and ultimately for humans who bear his image. Before Adam and Eve even exist, God is ordering chaos. And he's making distinctions and creating boundaries. The water comes this far, but no further. This light stays over here. The land is here. You know, these kinds of distinctions. The impression we get from the very poetic beginning of the text is that, you know, everything is kind of chaotic and formless. And God starts to actually make some order out of it. So much so that when Adam and Eve are created, how could they possibly view creation except as an enormous, unearned gift? I mean, as he's ordering the chaos and creating boundaries and all those things I just said, it's like he's getting his house ready for important guests. You know, he's making it a place where human beings could survive. And if you think of all of the order and consistency that human life depends on, or any life for that matter in the universe, like everything has to be pretty perfectly balanced for any life to exist at all. And things, you know, the physical laws of the universe have to be pretty consistent all the time for life to exist. So there's these, you know, this incredible order that's there, and I think God delights in it anyway, but the impression we get from Genesis is that he's creating space for his image to dwell. And so, how could Adam and Eve have earned this or deserved it? Of course they didn't. Most of it was made before they existed, so you can't really earn something when you don't exist. God gives Adam and Eve everything they need and much more. So it's a place of beauty and delight. It's a place where there is order already, but room for more order to come. There's room for exploration and for Adam and Eve to exercise their dominion in the world. So go out and explore this place, figure out how it works, and exercise your own God-given power in the world. So it's a beautiful picture of order, actually. It's not rigid and fixed, like a more Greek concept of perfection, unchanging, you know. It's good, but there's room for more goodness to come from it. Much more of a Hebrew idea. On the seventh day, though, the Sabbath, what becomes the Sabbath, or the sort of roots of the Sabbath, it says God rests. The Dutch theologian Herman Bavinck makes a really interesting point about the Sabbath. He says it signifies God's transition from actively making new things to actively sustaining everything that he's made. So there's this kind of movement from calling new things into existence and then rest. For God means, okay, now I'm going to make sure it keeps on existing, right? Which is quite a beautiful picture. He brings all things into existence, and now he keeps all things in existence. And that's what's happening right now, right? This is, God remains the sustainer of all things, even now. So there's no sense in which existence just continues without God's constant willful action. It's not the sort of a deistic view of God where he sort of makes things and then, you know, creates the physical laws of the universe and then kind of steps back and it keeps on chugging along without his input. Sometimes we think of the world like that, as this, you know, this natural world that isn't really, the supernatural doesn't impinge on it. It's kind of fixed and closed. And miracles are God kind of busting in and monkeying with, you know, the physical laws of the universe. Well, that's not the view of miracles in the Bible is much more, well, you know, everything is sustained by God all the time. Miracles are just God doing something different, you know, than he normally does. So, God sustains things all the time, even now. And this is what Paul, I think, is getting at in the book of Acts. He's in Athens, and he says to this group of philosophers, and this is a phrase they would have known, but he uses it to apply to the God of his scriptures. And he says, in him we live and move and have our being. You live, you move, and you have your being in God. That's another way of saying God is sustaining you at all times. Every breath is something that he chooses to give you. So it should be clear by now, the reason I've been rambling on about this is that there's a deep appropriateness to Thanksgiving if you think about creation and then God's continual sustenance of everything he's made. In light of Genesis 1 and 2, to say thank you to God is not a sign of extreme piety. It's not to go sort of above and beyond the call of spiritual duty to say thank you to God. It's actually the only appropriate response, and it's kind of a common sense thing, an obvious thing to say to God if we take seriously who he is. And as we look around us at creation and actually bother to observe the beauty and the wonder of the things he's done. But all does not go well. As you know, Act 2 is the fall, and Adam and Eve rebel against God. The story goes that they eat the fruit from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And this is much more than just an arbitrary act of eating a piece of fruit. It's really an act of grasping at God-like status, to be choosers of good and evil and determiners of good and evil for themselves, rather than obeying God's definition of what good and evil are. So it's really an attempt to be a law unto themselves. That's sort of a big abstract way of thinking about the fall, I think. But before any of this happens, I think, and this is something you can object to in the discussion time, which will happen. I think the trouble begins with a failure of gratitude, and you can disagree with me if you want, but I'll explain what I mean. So in the text it says that the devil approaches Eve and says, "Did God really say you must not eat from any tree in the garden?" And who knows what the tone of voice is, and I'm not sure what the exact Hebrew, you know, if I was a Hebrew scholar, I'd be able to say more, but I love the word really. You can imagine in the English language saying that in such a way as to really imply something, right? Did God really say? Implying, of course, how incredibly unreasonable it sounds that God would do that. Did he really do that? Did he really say that? Surely not, right? How unreasonable. Eve's response is, "We may eat fruit from the trees in the garden, but God did say, you must not eat fruit from the tree that is in the middle of the garden, and you must not touch it, or you will die." That's not actually what God said to her. If you look back earlier in the text, Eve is already starting to portray God as more restrictive than he actually is, right? He didn't say anything about touching it. I mean, maybe he didn't want her to touch it. Who knows? There's lots of questions in the text, obviously. But he says, don't eat from the tree or you will surely die. He doesn't say, don't touch it. But Eve is already in a sense, buying into the devil's interpretation of God being kind of unreasonable here. So Adam and Eve look around them and think of the endless beauty and diversity of creation given to them for their good and for their enjoyment. And yet, you can see a way in which, with the help of Satan, they become obsessed with the one prohibition in the midst of all the gifts. As if the tree of the knowledge of good and evil was the main thing going on in creation, and the command not to eat was God's main message to them, right? Maybe I'm just projecting some of my own twisted way of thinking onto Adam and Eve. Who knows? But you can. Again, you can object to anything I'm saying. And I think all of this subtly shifts their perception of who God is from being the giver of all good things to being a withholder of good things, which is a lie. So instead of telling Satan to get lost and remembering to give thanks to God on that day, they start to distrust God, and they actually start to think of him as someone other than he is. He's a withholder. He somehow enjoys withholding. Why would he withhold? It must be good, you know, what he's withholding. And I think all of the carnage that follows comes from this distrust, right? It starts with believing a lie about who God is. Paul, this is just a tiny little slice of a very complicated passage, but Paul in Romans 1 is talking about sort of humanity historically. He's not specifically referring to Adam and Eve, but all the same, this makes a lot of sense for me. For although they knew God, they neither glorified him as God nor gave thanks to him, but their thinking became futile and their foolish hearts were darkened. And so you think of all of the things that are implied in the words futile thinking and darkened hearts. There's a lot. You think of all the endless nonsense that human beings have committed in history, the foolishness, the rebellion. And somewhere at its root is a refusal to give glory to God and a refusal to give thanks to God. And from that comes all the blindness and darkness of our hearts. A refusal to acknowledge him as the giver with a capital G, the giver. And this question of, I think, still haunts us today. It's a question that all of us, on some level, who believe in God, struggle with. Is God first and foremost a giver, or is he first and foremost a withholder? The answer we give to that question will impact how we interpret our stories. Remember how I talked about gratitude as a way of interpreting your story such that good things are viewed as gifts. Well, our answer to the question, is God a giver or a withholder? That will determine, in large part, how we interpret our stories. So, if I'm not married and I want to be married, is God a giver or a withholder? If I was married and I wanted to stay married, but I'm not anymore, is God a giver or a withholder? I want a better job, but I can't find one. Is God a giver or a withholder? I didn't get into the school I wanted to get into or the program I wanted to get into. Is God a giver or a withholder? It's a very relevant question when we're faced with the fallenness of the world and disappointments. So the fall happened. God does not abandon his unfaithful people. And skipping way, way ahead, God establishes the nation of Israel. He calls Abraham as the father of the nation of Israel. And throughout Israel's history, he continues to remind them of the importance of giving thanks to him. So throughout the Old Testament, the significance of thanksgiving is stressed over and over and over. And you think of all the passages in the Old Testament that say, don't forget, remember, the founding event in the history of Israel is the Exodus. This is what gives them their identity as a people, that we were the people who were enslaved and God set free. Don't forget what God did for you. Don't forget again and again. if you forget, or I should say, the reason you're not supposed to forget and you're supposed to remember what God has done for you is that you will give thanks because of how God delivered you in the past, and that will renew your faith in Him right now as you're facing an uncertain future. So you remember in order to have faith that, you know, this the same God that delivered our ancestors is real now, and He's with us now. And the book of Deuteronomy is a wonderful book to reflect on in this regard. Most of the book is Moses speaking to the people of Israel saying, okay, this is before they go into the promised land. Like, when you get there and you get all settled and your grapevines start to produce a lot and your herds multiply, like, don't forget who got you here. Like, don't think that it was somehow because you're so smart or you're so wise or you're so righteous. Don't forget that it was the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt. So it's a lot of this language of remember who it is that's brought you this far. If you don't remember, you won't give thanks. And if you don't give thanks, you won't cry out to God when new troubles come. So, and there's certainly a refrain in many of the Psalms, just the ones that I was able to find that have this phrase in it. Psalm 106, Psalm 107, Psalm 118, and Psalm 136 all have this refrain, give thanks to the Lord for He is good, His love endures forever. Psalm 107, it happens like 20 times throughout the Psalm. It's obviously some sort of refrain that's sung, reflecting on the history of Israel, and then there's that refrain over and over and over again, His love endures forever. In the whole very, very complicated system of sacrifices, the sacrificial system in the nation of Israel, thank offerings were very important. There was all kinds of different offerings. There were burnt offerings for guilt, various sin offerings, free will offerings, peace offerings. But thank offerings were not among the usual list of sacrifices that had to be made on certain days, at certain festivals. They were voluntary, so they were given freely in response to specific events. So if you were an Israelite and something wonderful happened or something terrible was averted, say a relative was terribly sick and they got better, you would make a thank offering, which was a voluntary, sort of spontaneous act of worship to God. And in Psalm 50... the psalmist, who is Asaph in this case, he seems to imply that to God, and at least in the point of history he's talking, he's looking around him, and I think he's seeing a lot of sacrifices that are made with a lack of genuine love for God. So he's looking around him, and he paints this picture of the Lord valuing the voluntary thank offering as a clear sign of genuine faith, even a clearer sign than the endless sort of mandatory sacrifices that the people are making. So I'm going to read at some length from Psalm 50. I hope you can sort of see it. It's pretty small. Sorry. Listen, my people, and I will speak. This is starting at verse 7. I'll testify against you, Israel. I am God, your God. I bring no charges against you concerning your sacrifices or concerning your burnt offerings, which are ever before me. I have no need of a bull from your stall or of goats from your pens, for every animal of the forest is mine, the cattle on 1,000 hills. I know every bird in the mountains and the insects in the fields are mine. If I were hungry, I would not tell you, for the world is mine and all that is in it. Do I eat the flesh of bulls or drink the blood of goats? Sacrifice thank offerings to God. Fulfill your vows to the Most High and call on me in the day of trouble. I will deliver you and you will honor me. So there's this amazing connection between giving genuine thanks to God, fulfilling your vows before God, and then if you do that, God is the one you're going to call on in the day of trouble and He'll deliver you. But to the wicked person, God says, what right have you to recite my laws or take my covenant on your lips? You hate my instruction and cast my words behind you. When you see a thief, you join with him. You throw in your lot with adulterers. You use your mouth for evil and harness your tongue to deceit. You sit and testify against your brother and slander your own mother's son. When you did these things and I kept silent, you thought I was exactly like you. But I now arraign you and set my accusations before you. Consider this, you who forget God, or I will tear you to pieces with no one to rescue you. Those who sacrifice thank offerings, honor me. And to the blameless I will show my salvation. So, a fascinating psalm to study in more depth. I'm not going to dig into it too deeply here, but we do see an interesting theme here that God does not compel gratitude. He doesn't back us into a corner and say, "What do you say?" You know, like we were backed into a corner when we were children. he doesn't compel gratitude, but he does expect it. Something's wrong if you don't say thank you to him. And he even seems to think that it would do us good to say thank you to him. It's actually a way to thrive as a human being. Act 3, redemption. Summary. Yeah, the third point there. With the coming of Jesus Christ, I think the scope of reasons to be thankful to God expands infinitely. Not only is God the one who made us, who made the world, and who sustains all things by his love, he's the one who himself took on flesh and made himself vulnerable to pain and humiliation and death in order to suffer the judgment that was rightfully ours. So, and with the purpose of welcoming us who were once enemies of God back into God's family again. And just as God offered Adam and Eve his hospitality in creation, something they couldn't possibly have earned, Jesus offers us the hospitality of God in a new and a fresh way. Jesus, in a sense, makes God's presence a safe place to be again. And this is symbolized, I think, in the Gospels when the curtain in the temple tears as Jesus dies. It's this picture of the Holy of Holies, which is a dangerous, isolated place where you can't just waltz into the Holy of Holies. But because Jesus' death has dealt with our sin, which is the liability we have before God, now God's presence, because of him, because of Jesus, is now a place we can stand, amazingly. In Christ, the grace of God is displayed, and the grace is this wonderful word, which basically means favor that we don't deserve, undeserved favor. And he removes the guilt of our sin and what theologians have called the great exchange. He takes away the guilt of our sin onto himself, and then he credits us with his goodness. And so there's absolutely nothing we do or ever could do to earn this or deserve it or repay it. So there's only one way to receive this, and it's as a free gift. That's the only way we can receive it. It's too big to even attempt to pay for. It can only be received with empty hands. So as in creation, we have this new life as a result of a free, gratuitous gift from God, something that he is not compelled to give, and yet he does. For people who are Christians, I think it's more than just having a debt canceled. It's more than just being off the hook. It's actually that we've been given a totally new status. We're now children of God, heirs of God by adoption. And an adoption that's been made possible by the work of Jesus. So this is the sort of grand theological context in which we give thanks to God now as people who are living after the resurrection of Jesus. And if you look at the letters of Paul, and we sort of take note of all the times he writes, "Thanks be to God." He says it a lot. "Thanks be to God." It almost always is referring to the redemption bought for us by Jesus. And very often with an emphasis on what we've been delivered from. The darkness of the destruction. "Thanks be to God. Jesus has come." "Thanks be to God." Again and again and again. So this is, you know, for a Christian who reads the New Testament, the redemption of Jesus is the context in which our thanksgiving exists now. So we can see, I think, that it is a necessary thing to do, to give thanks. It's not an arbitrary or optional practice. You know, it's the necessary thing to do. And yet, that's only Act 3. Act 4 is the restoration or final fulfillment of the work of Christ. We're still waiting for that fulfillment. Many of God's promises that he's made to us have not been fully realized yet. And so Act 4 hasn't come yet, and Act 3 is taking a long time. It feels like a long time. We're waiting. And there's much that's still broken. So I think Christians are called to give thanks, in a sense, while still in the darkness. Our thankfulness to God doesn't depend on everything being nice around us. And that's one of the things that's profound about Thanksgiving. It's not naive or sentimental. It's actually a very robust thing to be able to give thanks to God in the midst of a lot of trouble. But biblical thankfulness is really something that is supposed to stand up to a lot of trouble. It doesn't fold under hard times. So, to give thanks for what is good, despite the many things that are not good, I think is what we're called to. All of our thanksgiving is offered in memory of what God has done and in hope for what will come, but always in a fallen context. And there are many, many things to lament in the state of the world, in our own lives, and in the world as we look around us. Many reasons to cry out to God to do something, to come, to heal. And but the picture, one of the main pictures I'll just quote for you right now. It's not a picture. It's just a way of framing thankfulness, is to give thanks in all circumstances. And this is one of the places that Paul mentions. This is in 1 Thessalonians. I'll just read this. And we urge you, brothers and sisters, warn those who are idle and disruptive. Encourage the disheartened. Help the weak. Be patient with everyone. Make sure that nobody pays back wrong for wrong, but always strive to do what is good for each other and for everyone else. Rejoice always. Pray continually. Give thanks in all circumstances. For this is God's will for you in Christ Jesus. Now, this is not in contradiction to what I'm displaying my ignorance here, but rejoice with those who rejoice, mourn with those who mourn. Where's that? Anybody? I don't remember. It's not in contradiction with that, to rejoice with those who rejoice, to actually celebrate the good gifts of God with somebody and then mourn with someone who's in mourning. These are good and appropriate things we're called to. But yet, at the same time, give thanks in all circumstances. What does that mean? And it's the main, I think the most important observation to make here is that he does not say give thanks for all circumstances. We say that a lot here. God isn't calling us to give thanks for bad things that happened, for things that are actually evil, for things that are a result of the fall, for things that are not part of God's original design for his world. If we were called to mourn with those who mourn, rejoice with those who rejoice, and then give thanks for murder, then that would make zero sense at all. And that's not what Paul says. He says, give thanks in all circumstances, which means life circumstances are changing all the time. That's what's implied by this. Sometimes they're good, sometimes they're bad, sometimes they're just confusing. And even in any number of different circumstances, the big truths of the Christian faith do not change. The promises still stand. The things we're waiting for and putting our hope in still stand. And it calls to mind the line from the psalm, that refrain. Again, give thanks to the Lord, for he is good. His love endures forever. That means in all circumstances. There's never a point where his love kind of phases out or takes a holiday. So thanksgiving is an appropriate thing all the time. That doesn't mean it will be an easy thing all the time. And it doesn't mean that in the midst of real hardship or suffering or pain, that thankfulness is the first thing that will come out of our mouth. I think that's a totally unrealistic expectation. But it does mean that there are things to thank God for, even in the midst of hardness and darkness. Lament and thanksgiving are not mutually exclusive. They're two aspects of worship to God. Sorry, that's my phone. That's embarrassing. But they're not in conflict with each other. They're just two ways of responding to real circumstances with God as the audience. I'm just going to turn that off before it drives me crazy. So we've done a lot of talking on lament before, so I'm not going to get into that too much, but it's not in contradiction to thankfulness. So I'm going to move on to this next main section here, which is living the truth. There's a wonderful portion of the Anglican liturgy. I'm not sure where it is in the Book of Common Prayer. I need a Book of Common Prayer for Dummies. I don't really know how to use it properly. But in any case, there's a wonderful liturgy that I remember when Nikayla and I used to be members of an Anglican church in Vancouver, Canada. And the priest says, "Let us give thanks unto our Lord God." And the people say, "It is meet and right so to do." So this is antiquated language, obviously, but the priest said, "It is very meet, right, and our bounden duty that we should at all times and in all places give thanks unto thee, O Lord, Holy Father, Almighty, Everlasting God, through Jesus Christ, thine only Son, our Lord." And the thing that struck me was the word meet. It is meet and right so to do. I was like, what does that mean? But it basically means generally accepted and non-controversial. That's what it means. It's basically the obvious thing to do. And I like that. It's sort of refreshing. It is very obvious and right and our bounden duty that we should give thanks to the Lord. So, for a Christian, I think to live a life of gratitude is not one lifestyle choice among other equally valid lifestyle choices. And this is something that we'll get into in the third lecture of this series, talking about contemporary secular views of gratitude, which is there's a lot to applaud in those. I'm not critical across the board, but there's some key differences. And one of the differences is that gratitude, biblically speaking, isn't just one lifestyle choice among others. It's actually nothing more and nothing less than being honest. It's about living the truth, living in response to the truth. And this means that at its core, thanksgiving is unavoidably a moral issue. To not give thanks to God is to deny him something that is actually his due. And this means that it's a moral shortcoming before God to refuse to thank him. And this is true whether we feel like saying thanks or not. So it's also a way of being out of touch with reality. So to express thanksgiving to God is to see clearly, to not is to have blurred vision, to not be in touch with reality. It's a fascinating passage in Luke's gospel. Luke 17. And Jesus is talking to his disciples and he says, "Suppose one of you has a servant plowing or looking after the sheep. Will he say to the servant when he comes in from the field, 'Come along now and sit down and eat'? Won't he rather say, 'Prepare my supper, get yourself ready and wait on me while I eat and drink, and after that you may eat and drink'? Will he thank the servant because he did what he was told to do? So you also, when you have done everything you were told to do, should say, 'We are unworthy servants. We have only done our duty.' Now on his way to Jerusalem, Jesus traveled along the border between Samaria and Galilee. As he was going into a village, 10 men who had leprosy met him. They stood at a distance and called out in a loud voice, 'Jesus, Master, have pity on us.' When he saw them, he said, 'Go and show yourselves to the priests.' And as they went, they were cleansed. One of them, when he saw he was healed, came back, praising God in a loud voice, and he threw himself at Jesus' feet and thanked him. And he was a Samaritan." Jesus asks, "Were not all 10 cleansed? Where are the other 9? Has no one returned to give praise to God except this foreigner?" And then he said to him, "Rise and go. Your faith has made you well." So, this one ex-leper, in the story, Jesus, again, doesn't compel the men to give him thanks, but he seems to expect it, right? the one man who returns to say thank you, Jesus does not consider his behavior to be extraordinary or especially pious. He doesn't congratulate him. The one man was simply doing the obvious thing, to come back and to say thank you. A little bit like the servant in the passage who's just done what he's told, the passage before this. You know, he doesn't get a big slap on the back and say, wow, you're awesome, you did what I asked you to do. No, he just did what was expected of him, his duty, right? And I wonder whether, I mean, I read these two passages together because they seem to have a similar little edge to them. Jesus is saying, well, actually, you know, to return to me, and we have to keep in mind, to be healed from leprosy is much, much more than just a physical healing from an ailment. It's a death sentence. It's horribly painful. It's the source of alienation from the whole community because you're unclean and nobody wants to get leprosy and you can't participate in the religious practices of Israel because you're unclean ritually. And so, to be healed of leprosy and to go show yourself to the priest is to be essentially welcomed back into the community in a way that you would not have been when you were sick. And because there's no cure, there's no expectation that you ever would be a part of the community again. So, to be healed of leprosy is really, really big deal, culturally, socially, as well as physically. And so, in other words, Jesus doesn't find this one guy coming back to say thank you to be particularly noteworthy. Even though he treats him kindly, he doesn't say, wow, you are so spiritual. What Jesus does consider noteworthy is that the other nine did not come back to say thank you. Where are they? What's wrong with them? They're out of touch with reality because they failed to acknowledge to Jesus the amazing weight of that gift. Perhaps they're thanksgiving. Perhaps they're feeling really grateful inside but not saying it. Perhaps they're just so elated that they just forget about what happened and they're running to, you know, find their friends. Who knows? But in any case, they didn't come back to say thank you, and it's a problem to Jesus, isn't it? So that's part of just what I mean by gratitude is living the truth. Thankfulness is living the truth. And at a very basic level, it's honesty. If we believe that God is who He says He is. Now, I think thankfulness is crucial to a right relationship with God. To be inwardly grateful, remember we talked about these two aspects of it. To be inwardly grateful and to express it outwardly to God in thanksgiving, I think you could say that it's a necessary part of maintaining a right relationship with God. If our relationship with God lacks that, then it is not a healthy relationship with God, and it's an untruthful one. And so I'm just going to look at a couple of different ways in which I think this is true. I don't know if I have a slide here. Yeah. I've already talked about this a little bit. It's a way of staying connected to reality of who we are and who God is. I mentioned this in the introduction. If we're not in the habit of giving thanks to God, we can very easily drift into the same delusion that we see in Genesis 3, that perhaps He's not the generous giver He claims to be. And if that's our attitude, I think we're not actually talking to the God who truly is. We're talking to some other false God. But we also lose sight of our own identity as dependent receivers, which is who we are. Whether we like it or not, that's what we are as human beings. We're all in danger of viewing ourselves as more independent than we really are and more autonomous, people who choose our destiny. And to give thanks to God is basically to get a grip and remember that God is the giver and we are the receivers. And our identity as receivers of gifts is something to actually embrace. It's not something to be ashamed of or to downplay. I call this owning our indebtedness. We're indebted to God, we should own it. Our indebtedness and our continual dependence is actually central to our identity. So to be completely dependent on another person is usually a sign of immaturity. This is what, children are dependent on their parents. They're not old enough, mature enough, strong enough to meet their own needs. We call an adult who's still dependent in that same way on their parents someone who needs to mature a bit, right? But in our life before God, to acknowledge our complete dependence on God is actually a sign of maturity. It means that we have become undeceived. We actually have a right view of our own dependence. And we're owning that. We're owning our indebtedness. And that's part of what it is to be a creature. And it's a good thing. As we develop a habit of giving thanks to God, I think we're embracing that dependence. Because we're acknowledging that, you know, the good things in our lives didn't just come from us. They came from outside of us. We couldn't have provided them ourselves. Secondly, thankfulness is a wonderful protection against idolatry. Let's think about that for a second. Let's do it. Obviously, that's a big scary word. But basically, idolatry is our human tendency to make God substitutes. So, to worship and serve things that are not God. The reason why we worship idols is that we're human beings and we're made to worship. We're made to worship God, but we're fallen human beings, so we worship other things. If we're not worshiping God, we're worshiping something else. And that's what human beings do. And you can't worship something other than God without worshiping something lesser than God, right? We're worshiping something less real, less significant, less good than God himself. And because we ourselves are made in the image of God, in a sense, we are the closest thing to God in creation. Your neighbor, your human neighbor who bears God's image. When we worship idols, we're also worshiping something lesser than ourselves even, not even just lesser than God. We're worshiping something less significant than ourselves, which is one of the reasons why worshiping idols is so denigrating to ourselves. It's to devalue ourselves. Very often our idols are in fact very good things that God has made. They're gifts from God, or they're things that God has empowered us to make, things that we have given meaning to ourselves. Family is a good gift from God. Sex, romantic love is a good thing from God. Parenthood, financial security, work, fitness and health, friendship, these are all wonderful things, right? And the more wonderful they are, the more likely we are to make idols out of them, right? So as long... And they're all very wonderful things as long as we acknowledge them as being gifts and not gods, right? They're wonderful as long as they're in their proper place. They make terrible gods, actually. And they destroy us. But they make wonderful gifts. So, if we self-consciously say thank you to God for the blessings in our lives, we're recognizing that there is a giver behind the gifts. And we're not making idols out of those things. The sort of definition I used in the beginning of, you know, a way of interpreting your life such that good things are viewed as gifts. If we view good things as gifts, that means we're looking to a giver. There's someone bigger, someone better than the gift itself, the one that gave it to us. And we are much less likely to make idols out of those things. So thanksgiving, in a sense, keeps the gifts of God off the throne. Keeps God on the throne and keeps the gifts of God off the throne. And this is, it's a very important point to make, that growing in thanksgiving and thankfulness to God is not about valuing the gifts less and somehow denigrating them and saying, oh, you know, filthy physical existence or something like that, whatever. So that we can focus on spiritual things more. It's not that at all. It's about defining those things firmly as gifts and then being able to really enjoy them as they are intended to be enjoyed. Not as entitlements, not as idols, but as blessings given to us by our Father to enjoy. But they're only blessings to enjoy when we're acknowledging our Father, the giver. Just very briefly, two last things, and then I'll wrap it up. I think thankfulness provides a wonderful resilience in life because it keeps us connected to hope without being naive. And this is something that Dick has lectured on a lot more extensively, but there's a lot of different ways to view the world and to view your life. If you're a cynic, if cynicism is one of your ways of viewing the world, you are suspicious of everything. You tend to see through everything or think you can see through everything to the true motivations behind everything. So a true hardened cynic has a hard time being thankful because you are always wondering, why is the person really doing this for me? What are they getting out of it? It can't just be a gift. If you read the Screwtape Letters by C.S. Lewis, it's wonderful. Screwtape is this demon, and he's a cynic through and through, and he can't believe that God just loves these people, right? He's like, what's he getting out of it? He's got to be getting something out of it because, you know, these people are miserable, and God is, he must have some hidden agenda or benefit to himself, because really, Satan can't imagine doing anything that didn't benefit himself, right? So he's projecting that onto God and being like, so, you know, we're doing a lot of research, we're trying to figure this out, we haven't figured it out yet, but God is up to something when he says he loves these things. A beautiful, and a very sort of comical or satirical picture of cynicism. Gratitude and thankfulness is to reject that, actually. It's actually to recognize the goodness in someone else that they gave something to you. Remember, it's an impulse to praise. And so it's not cynical at all. That's not to say that sometimes people do give us things with strings attached, and people do give us things and are trying to manipulate us. That happens, of course. But to really believe in thankfulness means we're not going to assume that's what's happening all the time. But it's also, and then on the other hand, again, something that Dick has lectured on a lot is sentimentality. These are kind of polar opposites. There's cynicism over here, which is you sort of see through everything and you see the rotten, twisted, corrupt, you know, motivations behind everything. And then on the other hand, you have sentimentality, which is just to sort of pretend that everything is great and to view everything through rose-tinted glasses. Thankfulness, biblical thankfulness, is not that either. I mean, thankfulness is, we're supposed to give thanks in all circumstances, and all the things that Paul says before that passage are rough. You know, be with people who are weak. Be with people who are hurting. You know, don't be idle. You know, clearly there's bad circumstances, but thankfulness is something that's strong enough and tough enough to survive those things. In large part because of the promises of God that don't change, even as those circumstances change. So that's what I mean by resilience. And thankfulness is it makes us resilient if we're in the habit of thanking God. Lastly, I think thankfulness connects us with what is really the fundamental Christian virtue. If you try to imagine all these other great things that we're supposed to be and remove humility from it, then you don't really have anything at all. Right? So humility is, in a sense, the foundation of Christian virtue, something that we should all be trying to grow in, and something that often we grow in through difficult circumstances. But I think giving thanks is one of the ways in which we grow in humility. So if you try to imagine thankfulness without humility, or humility without thankfulness, you can't. You kind of like, what would it look like to be humble but never say thank you to God for anything? That's not humility. What would it look like to be deeply thankful to God but not be humble? That doesn't make sense either. It takes humility to give thanks. We're acknowledging that we're not autonomous. We're acknowledging that we didn't create ourselves, that we don't save ourselves. And so because thankfulness is intrinsically other-centered, it draws us out of ourselves. And that's one of the reasons why people who don't have any religious faith at all recognize that gratitude is a really great thing. It makes you healthier. It makes you psychologically more healthy. You sleep better. You have better friendships. You know, there's all this scientific evidence in recent years done on how good gratitude is for you. Well, it's what we were made for, and it's also draws us out of ourselves, which people, I think, are somehow longing for. I think there's a lot of people out there that, whether they articulate it or not, are just tired with the narcissism of our culture and the narcissism they see of themselves. To be drawn out of yourself towards someone above yourself, towards the giver of gifts. I think many people are longing for that, longing to do that, even if they don't have the language or the belief to support it. I'm going to conclude now by just one little thought about how do I grow in gratitude. I'm not good at practical advice in my lectures. I sort of leave that for you to figure out amongst yourselves and email me any ideas. How do you grow in gratitude, though? We've talked a lot about this coherence between the inner gratitude and outward thanksgiving, and that's really our goal, to have coherence between those two things, to actually be thankful and then to say thank you. But that's not where most of us are. We are conflicted people. I confess this is sort of a lame thing to do, but I Google imaged ungrateful child, and I got this picture. So, at least she's doing a good job of looking ungrateful. She may be a very thankful person, I don't know. But most of us look a little closer to the children we thought we were than we'd like to admit. You know, the children that needed to be told, what do you say? we're a little bit closer to that than we want to admit most of the time. The reason I tell my children to say thank you, regardless of whether or not they're, they have genuine gratitude welling up inside them. Sometimes they do, hallelujah, but a lot of times they obviously don't. One of the reasons I tell my children to say thank you is not to encourage them to be inauthentic or hypocritical, right? In a sense, when my child is given a gift and they're like, oh, yeah, what else, or whatever, I say, that's not what you say, and that's not how you should be thinking either. Say thank you. Am I encouraging them to be inauthentic because I want them to say something even though I know they don't mean it? I don't think so. I don't know. It's because I want to develop in them a habit of saying thank you. A discipline of saying thank you. So that they will become, over time, better and better at recognizing gifts as gifts. If you're not told to say thank you, you will very often just receive gifts as gifts and not even think about them. I mean, so much of the time we are oblivious to all the things people are doing for us, all around us. Oblivious. This is where entitlement comes in, and entitlement is always harder to see in ourselves than it is in other people. There's a blindness that comes with it. Stay tuned for the, come back for that lecture. But very often we're oblivious to the things people are doing for us, and we're oblivious to the thing God is doing for us most of the time. But through this habit of expressing thanks, whether or not you're really bubbling up with gratitude inside or not, I think my children, and hopefully me too as an adult, will become more thankful, because it's a discipline of recognizing gifts as gifts, which is really what I'm getting at, is that, this gratitude is all about being able to identify gifts as gifts. And I think we're very much in the same boat as our children, as adults here. We need to be told, and we need to, in a sense, if we want to grow into thankful people, we have a choice to begin acting like the sort of people we want to be. Not in a disingenuous way, like, I'm such a thankful person even though I know I'm struggling here, But, there's such a thing as, I know what the right way to live is, and I'm going to begin acting on that, and trust God to actually grow me into that kind of person. C.S. Lewis talks about this somewhere, I'm not sure where, but there's a very helpful essay, if any of you know where that is, I'd love to know. So it's not so much being inauthentic, it's a decision to head towards true authenticity with the knowledge that we're not there yet. And that's where I want to end. And at La Brie, if this is your first time here, we We leave some time to ask questions and discuss or raise objections or whatever you'd like to do. And I'll go for as long as I can go, and then I'll probably pull the plug at some point. But if you have to leave, please feel free to do that. You won't hurt anybody's feelings. But if you'd like to stay and have a discussion, please do. Any thoughts or questions? Yeah,
Ben, your summary makes it sound like that one of the milestones along the way to thankfulness is actually thanks speaking.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, just be clear.
Yeah, I mean that's what I'm getting at the end. But it's not the place to stay. It's a matter of habits. Discipline and habits that will help us to become integrated in our gratitude and our thanksgiving. So yeah, I think telling ourselves and being told you should say thank you, and then saying it and being consistent in that is a way of eventually growing to be internally grateful.
So conscious thank speaking isn't so bad after all.
Yeah, I mean, what I'm getting at in the beginning of the talk was that thanks speaking, if we think that's good enough, and we just kind of settle there, and aren't viewing it as something that we're trying to grow in. You know,
okay.
It's like it's okay just to say, who cares what you actually feel inside. You know, that's what I think is really dangerous, because that's kind of just getting comfortable with hypocrisy, right? But that doesn't mean that it's, you know, the alternative is to just be so committed to authenticity that I just never say thank you unless I just happen to feel bubbly inside, you know, which is, that's probably what all of us would be doing right now if people hadn't told us to say thank you. Does that make sense?
Yes, thank you.
You're welcome.
I guess it can run both directions.
Yeah.
Like, if you're disciplined, if you need to move from your inward feeling to an outward expression,
yeah,
then, you know, that's the discipline you need to cultivate.
Yeah.
If you need to actually grow something internally,
yeah,
you move from the outside in. But so the disciplines are to move those two things into a coherence. Like
exactly. Yep.
So, yeah.
That's a good way of putting it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think final lecture in the series that deals a little bit with the, you know, what's the difference is there's common ground here between notions of gratitude that we read in self-help blogs or whatever, you know, and the Bible. There's a lot of common ground, but then there's some key differences, and that's one of them is that in a lot of these discussions, thanks keeping is just fine. It's all about self-care and cultivating an internal life of gratitude, and it doesn't necessarily go along with saying thank you to anybody at all. It's you know, so. But I don't want to. I'm in danger of giving that lecture right now, so I'll stop. But you're right. It has to go both ways, and I think probably most of us experience both of those at different times. Yeah. Yes, in the back. Hi.
I'm finding myself reflecting on your lecture, at the end of your lecture, on the interplay between gratitude to God and gratitude to other people.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm curious what you might say about the relationship between those. And if I could qualify my question a little, I wonder if you think sort of growing in gratitude comes first from practicing gratitude with other people that leads us to a sort of meta-gratitude in a theological sense,
mm-hmm,
or the opposite, like that we process everything in a theological way and that also helps us feel gratitude toward other people. And then as an aside, I'm thinking about the difficulty sometimes, like in an interpersonal relationship where maybe there's a conflict, and in my head I'm thinking, all right, so I'm going to solve this with gratitude, and I'm going to like hear the person in the most charitable way possible because I'm thankful they're sharing their ideas, and but it's not clear they're willing to do the same. And it's like, so where do I draw a boundary and say this isn't working? Or where do I say, no, if I have enough gratitude, I'm going to like push us into that place. I wonder if you have any thoughts on that.
Wow, those are, yeah. Gosh. Interesting questions. Yeah, the relationship of to go back to the first part first, I guess. I may ask you to re-articulate the second part later. But yeah, does gratitude start with thankfulness to people and then eventually turn towards the transcendent, you know? Or is it through our gratitude to God that we then grow in our gratitude to people? I think it depends a lot on who you are, but I would say that the first is obviously very significant in childhood. You know, when we're even babies, we learn to, Lord willing, if our parents have cared for us, we learn to look to our parents and love them and know we're dependent on them. Hopefully, grow to be thankful to them. And as children grow up, and if they're taught about who God is, and then that makes it, if they have a tangible example of what care and love means, then it's easier to understand what it means that God loves them. This is one of the reasons why a lot of people struggle relating to God's love and care for them if they have a terrible relationship with their fathers. You know, this is a very typical struggle that a lot of people have. So on one level, yeah, I think we'd have a really hard time conceiving of what it means that God is a father that's given everything that we have to us if we don't have any concept of gratitude to people. But at the same time, as adults, I think it can go both ways. And I'm sure there's some sort of mutually reinforcing dynamic there. You know, the more aware I am of the gifts that God has given me. Well, one of the gifts that God has given me is the people around me. Those people are gifts to me, as well as very often givers as well that need to be thanked. And so the two go hand in hand. You know, I think if I'm very openly grateful to God but never acknowledge what people are doing for me, something's wrong there, right? Because you're this capacity of recognizing gifts as gifts, I think it's about recognizing whatever those gifts are, wherever they come from. Any other thoughts on that? I don't have to be the only one to respond to that because it's an interesting question.
My quick thought is it's probably no 1,000. I mean, people are different.
Yep. Yep. I think that's true.
I think in addition to being grateful toward people, experiencing grateful people is very compelling.
Yeah.
You know, I think knowing people and that I think is one of those mirroring dynamics in relationships. why do they have that impulse to be thankful?
Yeah.
You know, whether it's toward me or somebody else or toward God, and you know, and then hopefully to rightly shine that light in on what is wrong with
what's
me?
The
that
secret?
Not,
yeah,
that there's not more of an impulse in me.
Yeah,
and so I think, my experience both of having people express gratitude toward me or just witnessing those expressions is quite significant.
Yeah, it comes with joy very often. The two are hand in hand, right? What's their secret? I think,
I've been thinking about, I think partly because of one of your titles in another lecture about the preliminary virtue of curiosity. Like, I've been thinking about what is preliminary to gratitude, and I've been thinking about awe and wonder and like an ability to be surprised by something.
Yeah.
And I guess I'm curious about your thoughts maybe on that connection too. And you know, I think like that is also something that can be cultivated, and that, you know, joy I think is one of those characteristics, but that's something that I notice in people. You noticed that, I missed that, you know? around people, or to be trying to nurture in myself an ability to see things, that makes me sad how easy it is to just plod along and to not be taken by anything.
I mean, that's one of the I find myself gravitating towards these lectures that will happen in the future, hopefully. So I don't, but that's one of the things that, you know, when we're entitled to something, we don't see it. Mm-hmm. It's like it comes to us, and it's such a given that we don't take note, and we're not shocked, and we're not surprised. Mm-hmm. And it's just what we're used to getting. So you know, and so that's comes with boredom, and when we don't get what we want, it comes with self-pity and disillusionment and all these other things. But to actually view something as a gift that didn't have to be. There's this potential non-existence of the gift, I think is a key part of like you said, like the awe, the surprise, the delight, the being astonished. If everything comes to us as just a given, it's our due, it's what I get, you know, then we don't live a very astonished life, right? Do you have something?
It's just can get involved, but I'm just looking at being maybe farther from gratitude to people and having bad relationships with people. One, certainly we're told forgiveness we've got to do.
Yeah.
But then, what interests me is Jesus' teaching. When somebody's even your enemy, he says love in action.
Yeah.
Doesn't just say emote loving feelings.
Yeah.
Broadcast them out.
Feel warm feelings towards them.
But it's walk the extra mile, give them a cup of cold water, and so on. And then, lo and behold, that draws you into more of what the whole of what love is, and can make you, lots of examples of this, can make you see things that you want to be thankful for in the other person.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so love is action.
Yeah.
So even when we have enemies, we're not helpless. We have to deal with the forgiveness issue. We can't build over a chasm of hatred.
Yeah.
And try and build some structure or hold the ground.
Yeah.
But then we're not helpless either. He says, think action.
Yep.
Think action. Don't try and conjure feelings. Think action.
Which is very challenging into the way most of us view love today. Which is, I'm going to wait till I have a really warm feeling towards this person, and then I'll act on it. Because then it will come easily, right? And to act, and even in a very almost moral way, like to act in some way that isn't what I'm feeling is inauthentic, you know. And I think it's very wise what he says, you know, and realistic, and somehow the only way I can imagine loving someone that really, really hurt me would be to just to grind my teeth and do something rather than trying to feel good about them, right? And that is a way in to actually a deeper love. It's amazingly wise, but also very challenging, and that's helpful. I think back to your question, I don't know your name in the back, sorry.
Elizabeth.
But just the whole struggle with really trying to extend ourselves and being met with a lack of gratitude is just, I think that's just part of human existence. and something that's obviously a challenge. I think many people feel this who really pour themselves out in service and don't receive gratitude back. You know, it's a hard thing to give of yourself and to have that received in an entitled way. And I think that's something that we need to be prepared for. And certainly if we're doing the things we do in part with the desire to be thanked, then that can be a real train wreck. Because it doesn't work out that way very often. But I don't know. I think it depends a lot on the relationship and the conversation. But a lot sometimes the best we can do is hope that the extent to which we can live in a grateful way can be appealing to other people. They can see, like you were saying, Sarah, that some can look at us and say, "What? You know, why aren't they just as jaded and angry about everything around them as I am? You know, what's going on here? Why are they able to notice things that are good? And if we can do that in a way that isn't sentimental and just like, you know, everything's nice, everything's happy, don't show me anything nasty, you know, that's obviously you know, a lie, and to honest people that's pretty unappealing. Yeah, I don't know. Any other in the back, Anna? Yeah.
You mentioned in the middle of your lecture that the idea of thanking yourself for something is, I think you said, nonsensical. I was curious if you could say more about kind of where our culture is on that very issue, though. Thanking yourself as well as just gratitude towards a non-determined kind of entity out there.
Yeah.
Because when we thank each other, we as a whole, like thinking of the like Boston area or East Coast of mostly not being Christian, when we thank each other, it's kind of obvious and logical, but if you look out at a beautiful mountain and you say, wow, I'm really grateful for that mountain, from a Christian perspective, that doesn't make a lot of sense, but a lot of people, I think, do it without really thinking about the philosophical or logical issue. A little bit similar to a frustrating instance I had a couple of days ago when someone wanted to change the Serenity Prayer for a 12-step program we were starting from God/higher power. Grant me the serenity to accept the things blah blah blah, and she wanted to change it to higher power/true self. And I had a little mini hissy fit because I was like, "You're praying to yourself. That doesn't make any sense." And she looked at me like, "I pray all the time to find that true self." Well, then who are you praying to? And it's like, it was a really, she was a very like spiritual but not a religious sort of person. So yeah. That doesn't make sense to me, but
interesting,
I didn't follow her on a logical level, and she was actually an intelligent and educated person. Too,
So,
like Sarah had mentioned, like modeling, and that's a really powerful way to hopefully spread that a little bit. But is there anything else you would say to the kind of place you find yourselves for?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm thinking about this a lot because that's the apologetic of gratitude is that's really about that topic. You know, there's this wonderful impulse to say thank you that's in a lot of people, most people maybe, and in our particular cultural moment right now, gratitude is a very appealing thing. We can recognize it as beautiful, a beautiful thing in other people, and you know, has all these health benefits too, which is great. But it's simpler to deal with when it's something very tangible that a person has given to us. But then, in reality, most of what we rely on, and most of what makes life possible and even enjoyable can't be traced to another person. Even if you're not thanking anybody for the mountain, the experience of awe and beauty that we have on a spring day or something like this is something that I think for a lot of people there is this kind of desire to say thank you, but the real key thing that's missing is a personal giver. You can, everything that I've been talking about here, and maybe some people will define gratitude differently in such a way as to avoid this, but none of what I'm saying makes any sense at all unless there is a personal giver. And if it's a person who you know, your neighbor or whatever, that makes perfect sense. But what about getting out of bed in the morning? What about, you know, the experience of awe when we listen to a piece of music? What about all these different things? Who do you thank for that? What person do you thank for that? Well, there isn't one person I can thank for any of those things, but there's still this demand that somehow the gift was personal. And remember, the key to gratitude making sense, really, is that the gift was given on purpose. It didn't just randomly appear. Our impulse to say thank you implies that there was someone gave it on purpose, with intention. And I think many, many people have that impulse without a belief in any personal God to say thank you to, and yet that impulse is there. And so that's one of the reasons why I think it's a wonderful opportunity for these kinds of conversations. Who is it that you're saying, does it matter that you're not saying thank you to anyone? Or I'm just basically giving my final lecture. You'll forget all this, but it'll be the sun salutation. I'm not a yoga person, so I don't know anything about yoga really, but I know lots of people who are into it, and like the whole idea of the sun salutation, which is not just a series of yoga positions that, you know, that benefits you physically. It's actually a discipline of gratitude. The whole idea is that you're saying thank you to the sun. And there's other yoga disciplines where you inhale love, exhale gratitude, and for the whole session you are trying to think of something you're grateful for with each breath. Quite an amazing discipline. It'd be not a bad idea to try that actually. But the whole idea of saying thank you to the sun, without which no life would be possible. That's true. Without which no life would be possible. But what does saying thank you to the sun mean? The sun is not a person. It doesn't intend anything. And is one of the reasons why worshiping nature doesn't work out too great a lot of times, because the sun would just as soon kill me as warm me. Right? The sun wouldn't notice if I dehydrated and died in the desert. Right? It's not a person. It doesn't love me. It didn't give that gift with intention. And so to say thank you to it is, to me, I have the same response that you have. It doesn't work. To say thank you for it does work, but then who are you saying thank you to? Right? If it's a gift, it makes all the sense in the world. Thank you, God, for the sun. The fact that the earth turns in relation to the sun every day, and it's morning, and I can get up, and the day warms up, and you know, if it's a gift, it makes total sense. If it's a giver, it makes no sense to me. So that's one of the main points of challenge, I think. And I'm really thankful that there's enough common ground between sort of biblical gratitude and contemporary, whatever you want to call it, secular gratitude. There's a place to start. We can both admit that gratitude is great, and it's good for us. You know, as a Christian who believes I was made for gratitude, I can say, well, I think it's good for us because it's how we were made to live. We're actually living in line with some very deep purpose that we have is to be grateful. The whole idea of a personal giver is really crucial. For any of it to quite make sense. And I think for some people who are very there's been a bit of a backlash, I think, in very articulate atheist kind of groups who want to make sure we know that they can be just as grateful as people who have religious faith. And that's true in some ways. Of course, someone who's an atheist can be a very grateful person. but there's a number of different... If you go online, you start searching for atheist gratitude. It's really interesting. There's a lot of very articulate people talking about how they can be just as grateful, and they can claim gratitude as a virtue for their community and for themselves without belief in God. And really, I mean, a lot of these people say, well, you can, anything that you really need to say thank you for, you can say thank you to a person for. And I think the thing that makes me sad about that is that really, in order to do that, you have to just ignore most of the most profound gifts and pretend they're not gifts. Because if you call them a gift, you have to answer the question to, you know, from whom. So, yeah. Does that make sense? Does that make any sense? Yeah, Nikita.
One of the things that I just think is interesting is our general response to moving to say thank you.
Yeah.
You say, well, you're very welcome. Yeah. And just even in terms of idea of what it means to be welcome to something and idea of dominion, like God is welcoming us to take a gift and have dominion over it. And the permission of a you're welcome or you're very welcome.
Yeah.
And what the significance of that works in relation.
Yeah.
Of giving a you're welcome as a permission to own and to take. And how often, I mean, why do we say you're welcome? Like, where does that come from? Mm-hmm. And even just like the grocery store, there you go, thanks.
Or Chick-fil-A, it's my pleasure.
My pleasure.
Yeah. But it's a similar idea. Like, you know. Who knows what they're thinking? Our friends at Chick-fil-A, but the meaning of that word at face value is, it actually benefited me to give you this, right? It's a pretty profound thing to say. It's interesting. I haven't really thought about that. Your welcome, in a sense, is inviting you to take this and saying, I really meant it.
Yeah.
On a practical note, my brain has had it and I were talking about this today, but something that I have found personally quite helpful is the prayer of examine, which is a very ancient kind of prayer practice of reflection, with the idea of being at the end of the day or the end of the week or the end of the season, of thinking back over that day, and it's these sort of twin questions that go side by side, which you can phrase in a lot of different ways, but the main one being, what was I most thankful for today? What was I least thankful for today? And the idea, you know, it could be, where did I most experience God? Where did I feel the farthest from God? I mean, it doesn't have to be kind of couched in the words of Thanksgiving, but I find it helpful. And then the idea is that you spend time reflecting under the kind of arc of those questions, reflecting over your day, and then offering back that to God, so the things that you were, or things that you were most thankful for, you actively thank God for those things, and then the places where the things that happened to you that you were not thankful for, or that you felt far from God, then you lay that before Him in prayer. And the thing that I like about it, and you alluded to this, is that I think for many of us, including myself in this, I think there are some people who fall into sort of Pollyanna land of like, I'm thankful for everything, and you know, which you talked about. But I think many people, myself included, fall off the other side of the roof, which is, I have nothing. This is all, my hands are empty. Nothing has worked today. Everything is conspired against me. That's where I go. And neither of those things are untrue, but they are not the complete. Either of them alone is not the complete picture of truth. And so I just think, as a practice, the prayer of examine has been a helpful one for me, because it forces those two things to come side by side of like, yes, there are places where I felt challenged, these things, you know, I felt the fall. I felt the fall today. But with that, there's also, you know, my hands are not completely empty, that I have been given something in this day or in this season or this experience. And so that's been a helpful yeah, there's just something in that that's been helpful for me of sort of those two things being mm-hmm. tightly paired together versus something in isolation. Like, okay, yeah. I'm just going to try at the end of the day to think of three things I'm thankful for today, or,
yeah.
which is not a bad practice, and I'm just not going to minimize that. But I don't know. I find kind of putting the two together helpful, and then the practice of taking all of those things together and offering them to God, both mm-hmm. in petition and in thanksgiving, being a much more holistic just picture of reality.
Yeah. In a sense, that's a way of, in a disciplined way, giving thanks in all circumstances. You're acknowledging the crappy stuff. You're acknowledging the things that are really good. And it's also a way of resisting both the cynicism and the sentimentality. And it'd be interesting. I'm going to write this down because it'd be interesting to kind of juxtapose that to the gratitude journal idea, which I'm not opposed to at all. We need help, like you were saying, Sarah, even noticing, even attending to what's happened to us today. Unless we stop, most of us, I mean, if I don't stop and think about what happened in the course of a day, I don't even know what happened.
Right.
Like, I go to bed, I'm like, you know, I'm too tired, I don't even know what happened, maybe I'll remember tomorrow, but then I, you know. So, to actually stop and be like, okay, what actually happened today is, I mean, that's kind of a big deal for a lot of us. And if we don't do that, what are the chances we'll actually recognize things that were good?
Sometimes the sort of awe and wonder piece that Sarah was talking about is retroactive.
Mm-hmm,
I mean,
mm-hmm.
in some ways, when I'm sort of forced into that of like, okay, I can easily list the things that need to be offered up that I'm angsty about.
Yeah.
But and sometimes it is hard. It is hard to feel like there's something thankful for. But I think sometimes that in retrospect, I can say that maybe I didn't fully appreciate it in the moment, but I can say, you know what?
Right.
Like, when I was walking back up to the other house tonight, this guy was gorgeous.
Yeah.
You know, that maybe in the moment of that, I didn't really grab onto that, but it was there.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's prayer of examine. Sorry, I'm just writing this down. I think that's one of the wonderful things is that you're... If all you're doing is gratitude journaling, it means you're as it, which is good. But you're saying, okay, I need to think of three things that I'm grateful for, and it's a little bit like thankfulness in my life depends on me just focusing on the positive.
Yeah, exactly.
Focus on the positive. Don't think overly much about all the other stuff. So if I got a parking ticket today, that would not feature in my gratitude journal. Which on some level is good. I mean, you're just, you know what? It's probably better to dwell on the positive things at the end of the day. But at the same time, if that's what gratitude depends on, is me just basically not thinking too much about the bad stuff and just trying to discipline my mind to become sort of a glass half full. That doesn't really size up with reality, and it probably isn't sustainable.
Right.
The thing I love about gratitude and thankfulness in the Bible is that it's something that can stand even when we're in the midst of real difficulties. So yeah, that's good. I like that. I'm gonna think more about the prayer of examine. Thank you for that.
So I just kind of stumbled in here and never imagined that I'd be saying anything. But I heard, my name's John, it's my first time here.
Hey, John.
I heard something recently that, like, when you're having a good day, it's called grace, and when you're having a bad day, it's called life. And I think that's just something you said, like, we think that we deserve it. We think that we deserve a good day, and when we're having a bad day, something went wrong.
Yeah,
you know, or like, you know, God's not providing for me.
Yeah,
I'm not happy. I didn't get what I want.
Right,
self-loathing, self-pity. So
yeah,
I just try to think of that. Like, it just when you're having a good day, that's grace. Like the fact we're breathing, we woke up.
Yeah,
you know, like just everything's essentially a gift, not just the things that we want.
Right, but if we have this notion that like a certain sort of baseline level of good stuff every day is kind of just the norm. This is what, I mean, this is just, you know, it's a given. It goes without saying, right? I mean, like all, you know, or even not just a day, even my life. Certain level of financial security, a certain level of, I should feel fulfilled in my job. I should have successful children. You know, if I have that mentality that that's the baseline, and then if God wants to bless me with any more things, that's great. You know, it's just, there's a recipe for disaster, right? There's a, you know, anything below that is really somehow a grievance. And that's, it's just, yeah, it's not the truth. I mean, you're right. I think good things that happen to us are a gift, and to be prepared in our minds that life is difficult, and there'll be days that don't meet my expectations. That's helpful. I like that. A good day is grace. Yeah. A bad day is life.
Just life.
Okay. Yeah. Maybe one more. Yeah.
I wonder if I can push that point a little.
Okay. Yeah.
That kind of extols the value of striving for greater, you know, pushing the envelope, so to speak. So, and I don't always think that's bad. I mean, I feel like there are times in my life where that's been a very good thing. You know, I'm in this job. I think I can do better.
Mm-hmm.
And I do, right? Mm-hmm. And then I'm thankful I made that choice.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, I'm in this relationship, and I don't think it's making me as happy as a relationship with someone else might.
Mm-hmm.
So I make the leap. Mm-hmm. On one hand, I mean, you spoke to this. You said we're not supposed to be thankful for a murderer. I mean, we're supposed to be thankful for gifts. We're not just supposed to be thankful for everything, every circumstance, but not everything. But discerning where that line is, I think, like on one hand, I'm hearing, if things are going bad, it's life, and if things are going well, it's grace. And now I'm thinking about how much of that is God's responsibility. How much of that am I just supposed to kind of stand with my arms open, being like, "I'm ready for what you want to bring," and how much of that is my responsibility to make my fields ready for more blessings? like, go ahead, leave that job. Well, no, I should be thankful for that job. No, don't be thankful for that job. Know that you deserve better. And I'm tossing out that tension, and I'm not really sure how to. It's nuanced, and I'm not really sure how to play with it.
It's very nuanced, and I'm sure that there's no one correct answer to that question, because it's has a lot to do with your personal wisdom in those circumstances. I think you could completely be thankful for the job you have, but still be looking for something better.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. You have a job. You have a paycheck. You can buy food. You can pay your rent. It's not the perfect job. I'm not fulfilled in it. Maybe it doesn't use my gifts as much as I think it should, and I can be looking for something else, but I'm grateful I have it now. You know, it's better than being unemployed on the street, you know? that's what I mean by it's nuanced. I mean, I can be grateful for something without being completely, complacent or content in it. I think that's one of the things that's meant by giving thanks in all circumstances. Giving thanks in an unfulfilling job. You know, I might really dislike this job, but if I look around me and a lot of my friends are unemployed and it's something that I'm grateful for, that's good. Even though I may be hoping, praying for, trying to find something better.
That's hard for me to hold. It's hard.
Yep.
It's really difficult for me to imagine saying, "I'm thankful for this," while giving it back.
Yeah.
Like, that's, so maybe I need to kind of think about my definition of gratitude, but I'm having real trouble with that.
Well, it's a huge thing are you married? Sorry.
Nope.
It's a huge thing in marriage, I would say. My wife just left. She should probably be here. But, there, in almost any marriage, I would say there are times of deep discontent. This person is just, you know, and yet we're supposed to be thankful for. I mean, unless it's a terrible relationship, a terribly abusive thing, or something like that. There's, marriage is a gift, even though this person isn't perfect, even though I'm pretty discontent a lot of the time, but I'm supposed to give thanks, right? Maybe it's a little different than the job because there isn't really a legitimate reason to be looking for something better. but there is a legitimate reason to work on that relationship and try to have it be better, even though we're thankful for it now, right? And so the two, I think, have to be held together in real life. Otherwise, the alternative is to be have Thanksgiving mean total complacency and resignation. It's just, I'm thankful because, and I'm not going to strive for anything different. I'm just going to be thankful with this. That's the passivity. But that's not what gratitude is. I mean, thankfulness is something we can have while we're striving for things and while we're longing for things and while we're hoping for things. And the alternative is just to be so driven, always want something more, that we never are thankful for what we have. So we have to reject both of those, total passivity and resignation and being so driven that we're not content ever. I mean, I think that real life calls us to, or God calls us to, in the context of real life, to be thankful and to strive for better things all the time, I think. Does anyone else want to weigh in on that? That's, mm-hmm. Yeah, David.
I would just affirm that that's definitely the case.
Yeah.
I walked in and saw a book by Tim Keller on marriage, and I think of this as like probably the best year of marriage I've ever had, and yet I'm driven still to pick up that book and another book that I picked up yesterday to look and try and make it better.
Yeah.
Because I think like when you taste good food and you say, I've never had, dark chocolate. Now I just want to try like every dark chocolate combination that I can pick up. So you're driven by the good.
Yeah.
And the gratitude welling up inside you causes you to pray and ask for, well, can I have seconds?
Right. Oh, that's cool. I like that. Yeah. I mean, it is easy. I will say that I understand the tension you're experiencing because it is easy to slip into a mindset of just like, go, achieve. If I get too comfortable where I am, I'll stop being a successful person, right? And that's, I hope to someday study and understand better, sort of this whole idea of the secret of contentment. I've learned the secret of contentment in all situations. You're like, what? What's the secret? Like, tell me, come on. He doesn't say. But to be content and striving. I think that's...
So I've just written down in my notes, and this is for me to reflect on, and it doesn't mean anything yet. It's my challenge that you've offered me for the week, which is you can be thankful for something while handing it back. That's how I word the tension, so that's what I'm
going to
think about.
So
thanks for offering it.
Yeah, let me know.
Like Psalm 19 is likely related. It talks about the sun coming forth, rejoicing as a strong man to run a race.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
I mean, strong man isn't running the race because he's scared. He's not running, he's striving. He's rejoicing in what he's got.
Yeah. And yet he's running the race. Yeah. Of sheer joy, yeah. And that's his description of the sun and the sky.
Yeah.
That's cool. Yeah. Sarah?
I think, actually, going back to Kayla's observation of the you're welcome, mm-hmm. and you should chase that etymology, find out where that comes from. But I think, to your attention back there, Elizabeth. Elizabeth?
Yes.
I wonder if bringing into play the reality of gift, not in the sense of like, you get to own this and keep this, but it's like it's a space to inhabit, and I think the Christian vision of this is like actually you're entrusted stewardship of all of this, and you don't get to possess it now, like God actually still owns this.
Yeah.
And so I wonder if there's something in that where that actually facilitates that kind of doubleness, of both delighting, exploring, enjoying. I'm welcome here. I get to inhabit this space.
Yeah.
I get to enjoy it, and also, like, I'm free to go.
to enter in and I'm free to leave this and see other things.
Yeah, because I have a problem too with saying I'm grateful and then thinking of handing it back. That would be that seems to contradict the thankfulness. But maybe if it's stewardship and it's, well, it's time to shift. And if discerning a shift is happening in the gift movement, then maybe it's you're surrendering and you're not giving it back out of gratitude, but it's not mine to hold on to. But maybe I still think your main point of people not being grateful and just constantly going for more is still a huge reality.
Yeah, for sure.
And I find that word really helpful. When you said stewardship, I was like, oh, well, that changes everything.
Yeah, everything we have is still God's, right? Everything's sort of on loan, but really, really on loan. I don't know.
It's given with freedom. I mean, and he expects us to do something with it.
Right.
You know, like invest it, explore it, employ it. You know.
But the image I have suddenly is, I think it pictures a lot. The image that I had before was God giving me a gift. It's in my hands, and I'm like, I'm so thankful for this. While also like kind of dumping it back on him. I don't want to be that same incongruous. But the image I have now is sort of like something very fluid, like water flowing through, or like, what's that game where you pass the ball around, like the Wonder Ball, and it's like a whole bunch of gifts are going around the circle. And that, so I'm picturing like my hands are open, something falls in, and I'm saying, no, I really do love this, but I don't love it so much that it falls into idolatry. I clench on, and I'm not willing to pass it on to the next person. I let go. Mm-hmm. I'm willing to watch it go to the next person because an even better one's on its way. Mm-hmm. I'm still thankful for that, and I'm thankful for the whole thing.
Yeah. Bye, John.
That makes sense.
Thanks for coming. Oh, okay, good. Yeah, I mean, I think very often in the case of a job or something like that, it's you can view it as I'm letting go of this to receive a different gift. Something new, which is very much an openness to something new God is doing. There's this wonderful, I think it's wonderful, I haven't read the whole thing, but the this book called Gratitude by Peter Lighthart, it's quite dense and scholarly, but the section I read was really fascinating because it's called An Intellectual History of Gratitude. And so he's looking historically on concepts of gratitude in cultures, but focusing mostly on Western culture, starting with ancient Greek and Roman culture. And it's kind of eye-opening because of the concept of gratitude in the ancient world is very different from our concept of gratitude now. To express gratitude, say, in ancient Rome, it has everything to do with reciprocity. If someone gives you something, you have to return in kind. You have to give them something of equal value. If someone gives you money, you have to give some. If someone invites you over to their house and is hospitable to you, you need to offer it to them. And that's what gratitude meant. Giving back. And we think of it almost solely in terms of heartfelt words. Yeah, thank you is to express gratitude. Well, you know, a lot of cultures today even, it's gratitude is all about reciprocity. So that if you get a gift from somebody, it's not a simple thing. It's a complicated thing. There's usually strings attached. And so to receive a gift is not, you know, like, okay, you know, you have to negotiate this. Like, how am I going to receive and how am I going to return in kind? Peter Lighthart has this really fascinating concept. So it's a circular picture of gratitude. The giver gives something to the receiver has to give something back. And it's a very tight little loop. And what he talks about is that the Judeo-Christian witness, particularly the teaching of, well, throughout the Old Testament of saying thank you to God, but also Jesus' teaching and Paul's teaching, it opens up that tight circle to the infinite God. And what he means is the teaching of Jesus that says, don't give to people who you know can pay you back. Give to people that can't pay you anything back, and your reward's in heaven. So it's really interesting. It's still reciprocal, but it's God who's gonna reward you. And so you can just keep on giving it away. It's not yours anyway. Like so it's this whole theology of that what we have is this, we're stewards of what we have. We didn't own it in the first place. Everything we have is God's. If we give it away to somebody, God sees that and honors that. And if I am given something, I don't have to. The person who receives the gift isn't bound to return it to the person. They can thank God, and then they can try to bless others with that gift. And so the whole dynamic is really fluid now. I have to acknowledge I don't own anything. If I receive something from somebody else, I have to say thank you to God, and then I need to use that gift as a blessing to other people. And it kind of busts open that whole circle of reciprocity that I, you know, ooh, gosh, I don't know whether to accept this invitation because then I need to invite those people over and I don't have the money, you know, whatever. All that kind of stress.
I read a very funny story, a true story, about back in the 90s when Soviet Union had just opened. Uh-huh. There was a group of Americans went on tour in Mongolia, uh-huh, where the ethic is exactly what you said.
Yeah.
And so towards the second half of the journey, all the Mongolians locally started to recognize, oh, these Americans, when you get a gift from them, it's really good. And so the gifts that the Mongolians had was buckets of yogurt and little half-dollar pieces of cheese, hard cheese. Mm-hmm. We call it noisy cheese. Mm-hmm. And there's this whole story about these Americans looking with binoculars saying, uh-oh, they're carrying, I see gray metal, and what that is, they're not carrying a bucket.
Yeah.
And they said, can we beat them? And they were trying to run as fast as they could. And they ended up giving away their parkas, their everything. They went home almost. Yeah. Not enough clothes to go home. And because these guys would give them a bucket of whatever, and all they had, well, here's my knife, here's my all the tradition stuff. And they went home just like, they had a heart for the poor people.
Yeah, yeah.
But they were actually running the horses as fast as they could to avoid the people.
To get away from the yoga.
Get away from the people who were resting after them with gifts.
Oh, man. Yeah, I mean, to me, it's eye-opening because I just sort of assume that gratitude means saying thank you, and then you're kind of, it's free, right? And to realize, that's actually not how many cultures today view it, and that's not how even it was viewed in Western culture. You see the impact of the Christian faith.
Yeah.
I'm going to, my voice is sort of about to go, so I'm going to call it quits, but thank you very much. I appreciate it. Thank you for sticking around. Yeah.
Thank you.
One tangent I didn't pick up on.
Yes.
I very much agree with you when you talk about being thankful in all things but not for all things. But I've seen people take one scripture and just that's not enough, but they form a whole theology in Ephesians 5 and say, be thankful for all things. Do you guys have a brief statement about that, or is that just...
No, that's something I didn't think
about. Okay. I mean, well, again, it's one scripture. Yeah. We know that you can't just take one scripture and go to all the other. Which people have done.
If you can put context, then you really are supposed to say thank you to God for everything that happens to you. I mean, it doesn't acknowledge that. It does. The rest of scripture.
Yeah, exactly. So, in fact, that was I would say, the only good part about it. Thank you for thank God for all things in Christ Jesus. Maybe say for those things which are in Christ Jesus. Not say thank you in Jesus' name. Thank you for those things which are in His name. Because I did something once.
How about yourself?
I said one time I was in tears.
We just moved here. Pray for it.
Praying for it. Oh, that's
wonderful.
One more thing.
How cool is this?
Yeah. 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 Yeah.
Well,
I said,
they love it.
That's what you
said. That's what I said. I said, I was in pain. I probably should have done it. It's like teaching by example. It's like no one listens to you when you're.
to you. They're the giver. You're the getter. And I was just so tired of being beat up in that situation. I got frustrated. I just said all these horrible things. Thank God for it. Is that what you had in mind? He said, no,
really. Yeah, well, maybe that was helpful.
I wasn't really the greatest friend of mine, but I was just frustrated.
In some situations, maybe, Virginia, in retrospect, you can look back and say, okay, this is how that particular difficult situation helped me to grow, and this is what God was maybe doing through it. But it's still not the same thing as saying thanks for that thing. Even then, it's kind of risky to make.
Yeah. But I think there's one little twist I've had on that. Jesus says, if you, being evil, know how to give good gifts to your children, how much more does God give good gifts to you? A lot of us would say, that would be a good gift for me. I'd never let my kid have it. So sometimes, if you think about, if it was my child that wanted to have it, this satisfies my... I want it. I know what's good for me. I know what's good for me. I don't want to make a theology about that either. But sometimes we think about, would it really be good for me? But sometimes we...
Yeah.
So some things are...
Yeah.
But Jesus does say,
so
the idea of calling out an evil, really is good. So I do.
To blur that distinction, to say thank you for everything. Yes, it's the same as calling evil good. It's not to say.
Yes, so they do.
I was just going to tell you, I think it's very mean, right, in our Bound review. I think that's one of the things that actually. Which would be interesting to explore Eucharist as meaning Thanksgiving. And also, I don't know the way that Christ's sacrifice is also a sacrifice of Thanksgiving. You know, to look at that link between Old Testament and
Yes.
We're celebrating there. I'll flag that for you if you don't want to.
He's correcting them. Summarizing some of the Christian theology about creation. And then he sort of pauses a little bit.
I'll drive in.
Have you sorted out a ride? No, I haven't. I'll leave here. $6 bus to New York, 7 o'clock bus. I miss your 7 o'clock bus.
We live in Tuscaloosa.
If you leave here, maybe a little bit, just to be safe, looking before 6:30. Sunday morning is
that'll
be your only how do I go about
ask the rabbis, pass it down tomorrow.
I think I'm playing using your metric. Maybe I'd be
here.
I missed it. So Josh, I never got back to him.
We did.
I'll talk to Joshua. We'll figure it out. I'm going to
the metric. That's
sad. I'm going to the metric. Right. But the park will work. Maybe I'll just take you.
It would be hard to beat that. I mean, if it's dead here and all
I'll talk to Josh and I'll go check it. He may already have plans for that. So if this if I don't drive, I may not see you tomorrow because it's my day off and I'm maybe I'll say goodbye now in case I don't see you.
Well, thanks for coming. I'm really glad that you did. I appreciate it. Yeah. It's been interesting.
But you can't go out here and see how much you
work. Picture where you're, have a visual image now where your kids are feeling for you.
As far as they tell me, the best team in this country is the Bay Area.
He was thinking of YWAM or something like that.
Okay, stop shopping around. Okay, well, that's good to hear. Sometimes you have to do that. You know, you're not gonna find the perfect place. All of the perfection you're gonna bring. How's it going?
Thank you.
I'm playing this stuff, right?
Yeah.
Of course,
this girl Elizabeth, she has to do all the
stuff. What? Really?
Yeah. She's because of the
master's score conducting?
She's taking music, yeah.
No way!
Yeah. Oh, good.
At the same time?
No. She's six.
Okay.
Have someone kind of think things through. Yeah. It sharpened a couple of questions that I have about myself. Some of the people I talk to, they really don't get about it. I mean, they go, this is great. This is great. I need to write that.
Yeah.
It sharpened.
Maybe push on something. Yeah. I was hoping that could have more than I could offer because of my lack of experience.
No.
Just not that. But it did. It was so good. I'm grateful that it did.
she knows needs to be done. Yeah, 3 or 4 weeks. You know, they're getting ready to go and meet Christine Holtz from our community.
Oh, yeah.
So, it's a good book. Those kind of things. And I had time to do a talk to Rashid Christie students. They were just impressed. One guy talking about a resident philosopher. He said, you should write a book. Some of her stuff, he felt was totally original to her. Yeah. I knew that it wasn't.
Yeah.
All of that chaos in her home and family. You know, there's still a lot to be done, but it's just encouraging to see those
The impression I got was not on any particular time frame. It's just a long walk, but heading in a direction.
Make a start, you know. Keep moving on somewhere.
Well, I'll see you then. Thanks for having me.
John,
hey.
Really
great. Good to meet you. I've never seen you at town meetings.
So you were talking about
it. I recognize that guy.
You were talking about like skepticism and stuff. I was like, damn it, that's my career.
Oh no, undermining your livelihood.
No, hopefully, truthfulness. This is not a sometimes motivations
really do exist.
My favorite is one of those slots that said you guys are willing to like give a piece of your land for road or something.
That's when I first started paying attention. That comment. It was and I was like, I came to the next meeting of the company. It wasn't even a selectman meeting. It was like a ZBA meeting. I was like, nobody's talking to us about this. Oh my gosh.
I love just the characters I meet, and like in general, like there is good in it, you know. The Bible itself is journalism.
So what's your background? First of all, how did you wind up here tonight?
Wow,
so I was glad to see you.
Okay. Well, I've been meaning to come for a while.
Okay. And
my friend, can I be completely honest? So a couple years ago, people from my church put an event together. It was like a Facebook event, like we're going to La Brie.
Okay.
And honestly, like, I thought it was kind of strange. I was like, this is kind of weird. Like, not really interested. And then,
No, I tried to forgive you for that.
So I'm like, oh, it's kind of weird. And then I became really good friends with this guy, Jeff Nacio. I don't know if the name rings a bell.
He comes.
What is he from your church?
He goes to the River Church of Malham, which is now Antioch.
Does he been here before?
He lives in Waltham. He lives in Waltham. We met at Grace Chapel.
Okay.
In Lexington.
Yeah.
You're exposed to other people that are...
Is he quite a thin guy? Yeah.
Very...
Grace Chapel is the connection. Yeah.
Very, very thin. So he was kind of talking it up, but we never like arranged to go. But then I noticed the topic tonight kind of on the heart. I really wanted to hear it.
Yeah.
So I called him last night and I was like, what are you doing? He's like, oh, I'm meeting up with a good buddy from high school. And I was like, oh, he's like, but you should go alone. So that's
good for you for coming in the door. You know, it's hard to... It's hard enough to explain what you're doing in terms of people, because of the category.
Yeah.
So, what
happens with me is playing out here for like the tea time. I'm clearly not going to make that. And then I was like, I'm going to be late for the lecture too. And then like my normal thinking is like, okay, I'm not going to go. So kind of thank you very much. So the next series in this topic is in March, right?
There's a whole bunch of other lectures in between. But the way I scheduled it was just I'll do part two of the last. Yeah, good. Okay. Yeah. So a whole bunch of different things.
I was telling that guy David out there. It's like it's one of those things where you're like, you you say something like, "Oh, I'm going to go to Labrie," and then like a year passes, and you're like, "I didn't go."
That was just the other day. Oh no, it was a year. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. So
I know.
I've been meaning to come for a little bit.
And, yeah.
So just the 2-minute version of my story is I grew up in Northboro.
Okay, yep.
I went to the Chapel of the Cross, which used to be where the senior center is.
Yes, yep, I remember that, yep.
So I grew up in the area, then I went to Gordon College, and I had, more so than anything in my entire life, I had such a clear calling to journalism that I can't describe it.
That's really cool.
And like, God, like I'm the kid who went in freshman year and like I had to take like writing 101, like because I couldn't test out of it. I just never imagined being like a professional writer. So I just felt like, for the first time in my life, just a clear calling. And then it isn't the easiest career to get into.
No, sure.
But I got a job. I was up in Gloucester.
Yep.
I was in Gloucester. Then that company transferred me to Lawrence, Mass.
Mm-hmm.
And then after a round of layoffs, they moved me to the Salem News.
Okay.
But the problem with that is I felt like it was kind of like a step back in my career. It's a smaller paper. It doesn't have a Sunday edition.
Okay.
And then a job opened up at the Metro West Daily News, which was kind of like the hometown paper.
So yeah.
So I threw my name in. And there's all this thing like the timing of when you should submit.
Okay.
Like, should you email like first thing in the morning or... And I was like,
in terms of when it'll be received and how serious it will take.
Should I send it at like 9 in the morning or whatever? I was like, you know what, I just want to get this off my mind.
Yeah.
I sent it just as the Starbucks was closing at 9. And it was a snowstorm.
Yeah.
It was like a snowy night, and it took me a while to get back, and I was kind of like getting settled. And at 10, I checked my email, and the editor had already responded. He's like, "Hey, I love your resume. Can we talk tomorrow?"
That's awesome.
Talked on the phone, scheduled an interview for Monday. This was a Wednesday night. He scheduled an interview for Monday morning, and then he gave me the job on Wednesday.
Oh, that's awesome.
And I was like, "Oh, can you give me 24 hours?
Yeah.
And then I really, like, called my parents.
Did you have to move? I mean, how far away were you?
Well, I was living in Salem, Mass. So I ended up. So this part of the story I'm not as enthusiastic about, but I ended up moving back with my parents.
Sure.
But the thing about that is like, I'm learning to like grateful about certain things.
Yes.
Like my dad's mom had a stroke and got really sick and ended up passing away. And just like I felt like I was able to like spend time.
Yeah.
With loved ones during that season. It's not like I'm going to be stuck there forever. Do you know what I mean? So, I'm glad I came.
That's awesome. And so how long have you been writing for the Metro West Daily?
Way longer than I ever met. 4 years coming up in March.
Okay.
So I started the first Monday of March in 2014.
Okay. And you've been covering a lot of the stuff in South. At least judging by your presence at the meetings, I assume you're kind of you're at least keeping your finger on the
pulse. Trying to be grateful. So. One of the reasons that I moved to the Metro West Daily News is when I was at the Salem News, they had me covering like 4 towns.
Wow. Okay. Yeah.
Like one of them was Marblehead and one was Ipswich, and they were like 30 miles apart.
Yeah.
It was just kind of like I was kind of frustrated.
Yeah. I bet.
And then this had to have been the most frustrating work experience ever. So there was a guy working Sunday nights, 3 to 11. I hear them call him into the office, and I can hear him say, like, "Oh, I really like working Sunday, all this stuff. Like, don't move me, all this stuff."
Yeah.
So they pull him off the Sunday shift, and then they call me into the office, and they're like, "Congratulations, you're working the Sunday shift." And I was like, "Well, I don't want to work the Sunday shift. I go to church. You know, it's my church day."
Yeah. So he took it away from the guy that wanted it and gave it to you who didn't want it.
They pissed off 2 people.
there's a solution here. I'm seeing the solution. We'll pitch you up and we'll pitch you up.
No, the thing is, he was covering a city and they felt like it would be more valuable to have him Monday through Friday.
Okay.
And I was a new guy.
Yeah. Mm.
But the frustrating situation is I felt like they kind of undermined me because I just got moved there. They didn't hire me or pick me.
Okay.
So I'm just a guy that got transferred there.
It's a moving piece. Yeah.
I don't
envy you the challenge of having to make some coherent sense out of the mess of South for town meetings.
So the reason I can't even do Metro West Daily News is that we're going to have me cover Hopkinton, only Hopkinton.
Okay.
Hopkinton is only Hopkinton, and I do bigger projects.
Yeah.
Well, like 6 months in, they're like, oh, we need you to cover Selfer too. And now I'm like right back where I was at the same time. He's covering multiple towns.
Okay.
So, yeah, I'm just taking it one day.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, there's some interesting things going on in Selfer, but Hopkinton is just a very interesting community.
Yeah, my parents live there.
I think I might have been coming in.
Yeah, maybe she was sitting in the back, and then my dad was also there.
You probably don't remember, but I walked in, sat there, and I think she went over to the couch.
She went over to the couch, that's right. Okay. Yep.
So the embarrassing thing was, I walked in, I was like, what do? You just walk in. So I just walk in, and then I hear footsteps behind me, so I kind of keep the door open.
Yeah.
She comes in, thanks me for holding the door open. And I was like, I hope you know where you're going, because I don't. She's like, oh, I think I know where I'm going. Started.
Yeah, right, yeah.
I was like, okay, that's humility right there.
Okay, fine. That's funny. Yeah. Yeah, I think the Friday night lectures are a good way to just kind of to experience La Brie because it's a low, it's not a huge commitment. Come check it out, see what goes on here.
I mean,
yeah,
I think the thing is, like, I get kind of the work week doesn't like wind down for me. It just like fizzles out on a Friday when I'm done.
Okay, yeah.
I usually don't make a ton of plans on Fridays. So okay. I just kind of swing by. It's a little later in the evening.
Yeah. Good. Well, I'll come back anytime, man. If you see a lecture that looks like it might be of interest to you, it'd be great to see you again.
So you live here?
I live in the house across the street. So there's two houses La Brie owns here, and so my family. I live up there as well as another person who's a worker here.
Your wife was here?
She was. She was sitting in the chair of the kitchen. She made the comment about you're welcome. We live across the street. My parents who started this branch of La Brie about 5 years ago, moved to Hopkinton because they were getting a bit older and they were making room for younger staff. Then we have two families that live in this house who live here permanently too. So Dave, who you were talking to, over there by Stephen. And then Sarah and Josh. Sarah was sitting in the front row with the glasses on.
He was sitting over here with his wife.
They live in Townsend. Different Dave. So the guy's still being disturbed. Oh, lives here. And then Sarah Chestnut, who's sitting near the front, who's lecturing next week. Yeah, she and her family live on the other side. So it's shaped like kind of a U, and the two wings are the apartments where workers live. But there's been about 20 students at a time here. So
it's funny just the perception of things. Like the way I envisioned it was very like professorly and very. do you know what I mean?
Yeah, more academic over here. La Brie has a funny history. I mean, for people that know about La Brie, when it started in Switzerland and everything, Francis Schaeffer had this reputation. It had a reputation of being very philosophical and engaging with very heavy ideas. And there was certainly a lot of that going on, but it was also very, it's a hospitality, man. People come and stay food together and work alongside them, and that's every bit as important about what happens here. So it's, we certainly engage with ideas a lot, but we're also like, okay, so how come you can't get along with people in the blank next to you? Like, what's going on here? There's a lot of very Oh, yeah. I don't know.
I mean, I grew up
real life things come up.
I couldn't get a job in journalism. So I found myself working for the Salvation Army, teaching inner city kids, like, hiking and camping.
Oh, yeah?
Never imagined
it. Are you an outdoorsy type of person? That's what you enjoy doing. Awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, right. Thank you.
It was really good to meet you, John. I'll maybe run into you in the town hall someday. If not, back here.
I'll be around.
Good.
My favorite is Hunter's. Prayer. His book is called Prayer. My favorite is Heart of the World. I don't know if you've read that one. It's the most unique kind of book I've ever read. The album. And most kids. Well, it's written like a. Allegory.
Okay.
I mean, he's a very poetic writer. Anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah, but he's a. It's
Hey there, Vince.
Well, so I kind of think I was in philosophy.
Great. Not really like
philosophy.
That good, like long lecture and like good discussion. Not really like. Put me into the academic, like, it's kind of like, not necessarily like, libido's kind of going slow, but it was kind of like at a gradual kind of like pace, and so like the intellectual, like, engine was just kind of like, just idling, kind of, and just like revved it up. And, like,
oh, good. Good.
Now I'm here, you know, because I still haven't, it hasn't been a week since I've been here.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, hasn't been long.
And it's up because they said, like, a friend told me that, like, the first day was her birthday, and, like, I missed that, you know? But I didn't even know that I was going to come here till Wednesday.
You made a decision late, right? And you emailed us, and then you drove from Georgia, right? Yeah. I remember. It's like, all right.
It was kind of crazy, too, because, like, I was expecting, like, a long, like, not long application process, but just a little bit more.
Oh,
like,
no, yeah.
This is kind of who, like, they're trusting me, you know?
We don't have a rigorous screening process at all.
Because it's I'll study a little bit, so, you know?
You want to come? You sure you want to? Okay, good, you can go.
Have y'all ever had to tell people to leave?
Occasionally, yep.
Yeah.
We,